Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Yankee Magazine, a staple in many New England homes, turns 75 this year. It's gone through many changes over the years, including a redesign from a small pocket-sized publication to a standard format magazine. Yankee readers have come along for the ride, although not without some occasional protesting. The editor of Yankee Magazine, Mel Allen, says there's no region better suited to its own magazine than New England.
This is a very complex, contradictory region. If you think about it, we have the same New England region. It's the most compact in America. You can drive from Connecticut to the wilds of Maine in a handful of hours. You can wake up in the morning and climb Mount Washington, and you come back down, you get in the car, and an hour later you're eating in a restaurant in Portland. So we have this, we have an identity. And when you say you're a New Englander, there's a sense of belonging. I think anywhere in the world, if somebody says where you're from and you say New England, they get like a visual picture. We have traditions. We have our own history. We have this landscape. And most of all, we have this common memory. And so that's what a magazine is supposed to do. It's supposed to bring readers together. And we've found over the years that readers actually have a very personal relationship with Yankee. I went to do a story back in the 1990s with Alan Shepard, the astronaut. And it was on an anniversary of when he had landed on the moon. And he said to me, you know, I've had lots of phone calls from other media asking me to do this interview. And I've said no to all of them. But I said yes to you, to Yankee Magazine, because he said Yankee is home.
Because he was from the area.
Yeah, he's from New Hampshire.
Huh.
And he said, Yankee is home. And that's why we have this magazine. It's always represented home, and that home is New England.
So for all those reasons, a couple named, I think, Rob and Trick Sagendorf back in 1935 decided to create this magazine.
It sounds almost like a folktale. It actually literally started on a hillside in Dublin, New Hampshire, in a hexagon shack. That hexagon shack still stands on this hillside. Rob Sagendorf had one typewriter, a wood stove, and he had this dream. He was a frustrated freelance writer. He had gone to Harvard, so even though he liked to portray himself as like the backwoods kind of cantankerous Yankee, he was a very highly educated man, and he married well. Trix came from some money, and she helped support this fledgling magazine. And it started with just a handful of subscribers. You know, the story goes that we started with 614 subscriptions. Of those 614, 600 of them came from a fraudulent mail order agency.
That's right.
So really we started with 14 real subscribers.
So they shelled out money to get an instant ready subscription list, and it turns out that not that many of them were actually good addresses.
Exactly. And that first issue was September 1935.
Now, one of the signature things about this magazine for a long time was its small size. It was considered digest size, kind of like Reader's Digest size. And I didn't know until I started reading a little bit in preparation for talking to you that there is actually a really interesting story about why it was that size. It wasn't just an intention to be quirky.
Yeah, you know, when Rob started, he started with the regular large format magazine that everybody you're used to seeing on any newsstand. And then World War II came along, and we had a paper shortage. So Rob was a smart Yankee, and he thought, well, here's how I can do my part. And so he just shaved off, you know, a couple inches from the height and a couple inches from the width, and we had a 6x9 magazine, and that became our signature look.
There was all to no save other paper. All to save paper.
Yes, to save paper. There was no other magazine in the country quite that size. And then, you know, this went on for decade after decade after decade. When I became editor, my first issue, the January-February 2007 issue, went back to its original size. There was an outcry from these loyal readers. New Englanders do not like change size.
So this was a magazine that when you came in, you changed back to a more conventionally, traditionally sized magazine.
More conventional. And it was a decision that went through a lot of different discussions with different people. I got a phone call from a beauty parlor in Keene, New Hampshire. And the woman said, I have a room full of angry women in here. And the reason being that Yankee no longer fit inside their pocketbook. And, you know, for that was one of Yankee's signature benefits. You could carry it around with you wherever you went and just take it out whenever you had to stop, wherever you were.
So readers were mad at you, but you've stood by that decision.
We actually got a letter after a year of the new size Yankee from a man who said, you know, I wrote you a very angry letter when I got my first issue when you became editor. And now my mouth is full of crow, he said. He says, I love what you've done with the new size. And the new size has let us actually explore much larger format photography and all those kind of things that lead to those decisions.
I imagine there's some people that still long for the tiny pocket size magazine.
Hey, I love the tiny pocket size magazine. I came to Yankee in 1979. This was the magazine that I basically learned this whole profession. You know, all my stories were in that little magazine. But, you know, times do change. And we wanted to make a statement that we're not just your grandmother's Yankee. Take a new look at us. And it's worked.
Another distinctive feature of Yankee has been some of its old-timey columns. I'm thinking about those swap columns spelled S-W-O-P. For listeners who don't know what that is, do you want to explain what those swap columns are?
Yeah, you know, if you have a great antique rug or something, but what you really want is to spend a week on the main coast, you would put in Yankee, I have this antique hooked rug from my great-grandfather, would love to swap it, S-W-O-P, for a week at your cottage in Maine, or what have you. It would always be like, or what have you, and that was immensely popular, and it was a prophet, basically, of how people have come to, you know, to use the internet today.
Now, there was also a column called Sayings of the Oracle. I haven't read this except in its archive forms, because I think it was published started in the 40s and then ended in the 70s. But as I understand it, you could write in with sort of advice questions. You know, how do you fix an old clock? How do you bruise liquor, whatever bruising liquor means? And I understand that the Judson Hale, the editor-in-chief, told the columnists of this column, Sayings of the Oracle, this was a columnist named Joe Allen, that he might not actually publish every answer he wrote, but he would never edit a published answer. And I came across here one answer that the editor-in-chief, Judd Hale, shared after Joe Allen had died. He said that he didn't have the guts to publish this in the magazine. Now, the question that the columnist was asked was, why are covered bridges covered? To keep the snow off? And this is the answer that the columnist wrote. This is the answer that was not published.
I know this one.
You know
Jesus
this one?
For God Almighty. Go ahead.
Exactly. He writes, Jesus for God Almighty. We thought all hands knew by this time. Bridges were covered, damn fool, for the same reason women used to wear petticoats, to protect their underpinnings. Ever hear that wood rots when it gets wet? Your asinine suggestion that they were covered to keep snow off the road is dead wrong. In fact, I recollect throwing snow inside the bridges after a snowstorm so our sleighs wouldn't grind on the wood. As to the height of covered bridges, any simpleton would know it took some height to get a full hay wagon through. So this guy sounds like, you know, at that point he was sick and tired of getting questions that he thought everybody should know the answer to.
You know, Joe Allen, during those years, was one of those voices that sort of set Yankee apart. He was actually the editor of the Vineyard Gazette on Martha's Vineyard, but he came across as the, you know, thick-crusted New Englander who had no time for fools, but actually he had a heart of gold. And he knew everything there was about the folklore and the traditions and the history of New England.
There was another sort of crusty New Englander, I think. There's a columnist named Earl Prue. He was a Yankee handyman. Would you categorize him the same way as a crusty New Englander?
You know, when I came to Yankee, there was Earl. He looked like Mr. Clean, you know, bald, stout, in his blue work clothes. And, you know, Earl was a guy who made sure that Yankee just ran. You know, he had a crew under him who built offices and fixed potholes, and he kind of personified what people think of as a Yankee. Well, he was self-reliant, and he was ingenious, and he loved traditions and history. He would rather work with a hand tool than any power tool in the world. He was so practical. He knew things to do with vinegar that you can't ever dream of doing with vinegar. To anything in your house, we used to laugh that he had a remedy for anything in your house that had to do with vinegar or apple cider. One of my favorite stories about Earl is the women of New England. he became sort of like a sex symbol to them. You know, he was this older guy, and he would get these letters, and all these women would say, the first thing I turned to in Yankee Magazine is Plain Talk by Earl Prue. And they just loved his voice of authority. He loved that he could just give them straight answers, and actually they could take what he said and they could go out to into their house or into their yard, and they could fix whatever had to be fixed, men and women.
I came across a phrase today that is associated with Yankees that I'd never heard, but it gets at their kind of frugality and practicality. And it says, use it up, wear it out, make it do, or do without.
Do without. I wrote a column actually during the height of the disaster of the recession just a few years ago. You know, all the national commentators were saying, you know, what a mess we're in. We're going to have to spend our way out of it. And my column was, well, you know, the Yankees have always known you don't have to spend your way out of it. You just learn ways to survive and thrive within that ethos, you know. And Yankees have never been, rich or poor, people who just spend for spending's sake. They've always loved value. And I think that might define really what we try to do in our magazine, is whether it's travel, home, food, or whatever, we try to emphasize that the people that we're writing about, they have a real sense of value.
So in the time that you've been here, so since about 1970, and in the time you've been working for Yankee Magazine since 1979, what do you think has changed about the Yankee personality?
One of the biggest changes is the true Yankees had to become more accepting of diversity. There's no question. You know, I mean, right now, there are cities in New England that have huge influxes of people who have had to immigrate from Somalia or...
Lewiston, Maine, right?
Lewiston, Maine. A story we did about how Lewiston natives were trying to adapt to this whole new personality of its city. Huge parts of Lowell with people from the Far East, and Hartford with its Caribbean population and so on. I mean, I can't think of any change that's been more dramatic than that. That is, if you are a New Englander, you no longer can just say a New Englander has a certain look and a certain background. A lot of New Englanders did not come over on the Mayflower. A lot of New Englanders have come over in the past generation.
So as New England has changed, the magazine has had to change, as you've talked about. But how do you do that without alienating those old-time Yankee readers?
I think you've been sitting in on our editorial meetings, because that's at the question of every editorial meeting when we plan our issues, is we need to have the people who've been with us for 20 years, 30 years, we need to have this magazine feel like it's their home. At the same time, if you're picking up Yankee for the first time, we want to have you be engrossed with what we're doing. And it goes back to what Judd Hale always told me. You find a story that fascinates you, you have to trust it's going to fascinate your reader.
So you've got to be contemporary, but you've also not got to lose that old New England essence. And I have to tell you the story. One of our young interns this week was reading a copy of Yankee that had come in as we were preparing to talk to you. And someone else who works here walked by and said, "What are you doing reading Yankee? No one reads that unless they're 80. So how do you deal with that stereotype that's for old, white-haired, you know, Vermont and New Hampshire types?
Sasha, that's a question that has haunted me for all my years at Yankee, because I know the stories that we publish. You know what? My son, Josh, who's now 22, 2 years ago, he was a summer intern at Yankee. He never read Yankee. You know, his dad was an editor, but you know how your kids aren't necessarily going to read what you're doing.
Sure.
But that summer when he was an intern, his job was to find the classic Yankee stories to go on our website for the 75th anniversary. I gave him Yankees from 1935 until 2010, and I gave him some guidance. And he, every day he would come and say, "I had no idea how cool this stuff was." And, you know, that's basically, in a nutshell, we do some really cool stories. And you know what? You have to do it a reader at a time, Sasha, a reader at a time.
Mel, in the September-October issue of the magazine, there was a article headlined, "How New England Are You?" And then the subhead was 75 Things That Every New Englander Should Do. Now, we certainly don't want you to go through all 75. I doubt you'd remember all 75 off the top of your head. But tell us the top five things that every New Englander should do. And maybe you don't have to keep us in Massachusetts, but think about Massachusetts if you can.
Well, you know, Sasha, this top five is going to be different for any one of your readers, because the kind of person they are would probably help dictate it. But for me, I would say, you know, Bostonians have probably seen Bunker Hill, you know, a couple days of the week just driving, but how many of them have actually climbed it? 294 steps. And, you know, some of the firemen in Boston actually train for cardiovascular by running up those steps. So I would say climb Bunker Hill Monument. That's one.
I was there once, and a high school football player was running up to train in preparation for the fall season.
There you go. I would say that Massachusetts drivers have the reputation nationwide as being maybe the most hazardous drivers in the country. So why not try out your driving skills and go on the Braintree Merge? It's, you know, from the end of the entrance ramp, I-93 to Route 3, exit 37, it's what we called ready, set, merge. In 1/10 of a mile, you have to cross three of those lanes, and I think it's a handful of seconds for each lane. And remember, all the drivers to the left and right of you are all Boston drivers, and they all know that they can't let you actually merge. So that's sort of like it's like a reality TV show every time you enter the Braintree Merge. So that's two. I would say, you know, people think that Cape Cod ocean water in summer might be a little chilly, but I say go over to Maine and maybe go to Penobscot Bay and jump in the water and do that at least once so you understand what really cold New England water is.
Water that makes you scream when you hit it.
Yes, put that on your life list. Another one might be anybody can have a slice of apple pie, but New Englanders know, and especially Vermonters, that you're going to have apple pie with a slab of cheddar cheese next to it, and you're going to have it for breakfast. That's that's kind of rooted in the New England way of life.
Is there a place you recommend getting a good slice of apple pie with cheddar cheese on it?
Oh, well, I'm not going to tell you one place, but just start driving and stop at a diner.
Can't go wrong.
You can't go wrong with apple pie in a New England diner, and make sure it's cheddar cheese from Vermont. And then you could maybe go to one of our living history museums like Plymouth Plantation or Sturbridge, and we call it having an awkward conversation with someone who won't break character. Because, you know, if you go to Plymouth and you're trying to, their job is to be living in this early 17th century. And that's the thing about having more history than the rest of the country. There's more of it to come back and haunt you. And those are my five.
And the other 70 are in the magazine, right?
They're all in the magazine. I loved working on that October issue, which actually people can get for free at yankeemagazine.com. They can just see their 75 things and see how many of them they've actually done.
Mel Allen, thanks for coming on Radio Boston.
You asked some great questions, Sasha.
Thanks. To read some of the older Yankee Magazine columns we talked about and to see a slideshow of Yankee Magazine covers, visit our website, wbur.org/Boston. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR with regular contributions from The Angle at Boston.com. If you want to comment on our show, you can do that at wbur.org/Boston. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Have a happy Thanksgiving and join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.